The Supreme Court for the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Herndon presiding.
All right, good afternoon. Are you all ready to proceed? Okay, give us just a second to get set up. All right, Mr. Chance, on behalf of the appellants, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal? Okay, you can go ahead and proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Travis Chance on behalf of appellate James F. Thompson, Jr., doing business as American Southwest Electric. Nevada's anti-SLAPP statute does not insulate defendants from all liability for the exercise of certain First Amendment rights. It is only a procedure intended to weed out early on meritless claims. And so where a plaintiff provides sufficient evidence of its claims at the outset of the case, the claims survive, and the motion has to be denied. Now, certain of ASC's claims in this case are premised upon respondent's submission of a set of false and fraudulent wage claims to the Nevada Labor Commissioner. Each of those wage claims made the same allegation against ASC, which is specifically that four ASC workers on prevailing wage projects were on payroll as laborer but conducting electrical work. In other words, it was an allegation of fraudulent or falsified payroll records on prevailing wage projects. Now, the only burden that ASC carried in the lower court was on the second prong. So I'll start there and then I'll turn to the first prong analysis. The only amount of evidence that ASC had to provide on the second prong was minimal. It's prima facie evidence. And the cases describe the procedure to be employed as summary judgment-like. And while the two processes are similar, there are some subtle differences. Chief among them is that the evidentiary burden on the second prong is only on the non-movement plaintiff. The burden of proof, again, is prima facie. And what the cases demonstrate is that ASC in this case had to provide admissible evidence, taken as true, and drawing all reasonable inferences in its favor that set out the elements of its implicated claims. But like summary judgment, there is no weighing of any competing or contrary evidence on the second prong. So the threshold question on the second prong is whether ASC met that burden, and it did. As this court, I'm sure, is painfully aware, this is a very dense record, and that's because it is filled with evidence meeting the elements of ASC's claims in this case. Now, in response to that showing, respondents were not permitted to provide contrary factual evidence on the elements of the claims at issue. The only evidence that respondents could provide was evidence showing additional facts that establish a legal defense to the claim. So that's something like an affirmative defense. That's not what respondents did in this case. Respondents presented a host of contrary factual evidence, and the justification they gave for doing so was that it showed the quote unquote true cause of ASC's harms, and it showed that ASC had no or speculative damages. Now, the trouble with that justification is that it was incumbent upon ASC in the first instance to provide evidence showing those elements. So respondents were permitted to contradict whatever evidence ASC adduced and set out in the record on those issues. And it is exactly that evidence that respondents presented that muddied the waters in the record below, because what we saw was that the district court took respondents' evidence as true, compared that to ASC's allegations in the complaint, not even ASC's evidence, and determined that ASC did not contradict the respondent's evidence. And that's error on several levels. First, it shows that the lower court did not take ASC's evidence as true as required in the first instance. It also is the entire opposite of the appropriate procedure. The only constitutionally permitted procedure on the second prong would have been to take ASC's evidence as true, draw all reasonable inferences in favor of ASC, and determine whether that met the elements of the claims at issue. If so, the court was to evaluate respondents' evidence to determine if it made out a legal defense to the claims, and if not, the motion was to be denied. And that error was compounded because The lower court also applied a preponderance of the evidence standard at the second stage instead of the minimal prima facie burden. And so the question really before the lower court and before this court again today is, would ASC's claims have survived a summary judgment motion based on the evidence that it provided? And the answer to that is yes. Now, the lower court also erred in its determinations on the first prong. The burden on the first prong is different than the second. It's by a preponderance of the evidence. And so weighing competing evidence is permissible. Making credibility determinations is also permissible on the first prong. So respondents needed to show two things by a preponderance. They needed to show that ASC's claims were based on a protected communication as defined in the statute. They also needed to show that those communications were true or they were made without knowledge of falsehood. And as this court has reaffirmed most recently in Abrams v. Sansone, that analysis necessarily starts with looking at the complaint and looking at the allegations, looking at
the
claims.
Counsel, would you agree that any communications within the NLC, the Nevada Labor Commission, would be protected speech and fall within the anti-SLAPP statutes as one of the four or five, I believe it is, protected communications? Particularly communications or a complaint to the state or a political subdivision of the state regarding a matter reasonably of concern to the governmental agency?
Sure. And I would agree with you that communications that fall to the labor commissioner that do fall within that category, they are protected. That's not the end of the analysis. We then have to ask, are they true or were they made without knowledge of falsehood, right? So it's two different things here. So
was there an actual finding, though, that there were... that the wages weren't being paid according to, to law, and that there were the supervisor wasn't on site, and there was some kind of settlement that happened, but the claims actually were investigated and found to be truthful.
So we have a few different sets of claims here, right? And so I think what Your Honor may be highlighting is the union complaint that was filed following the first set of complaints. And I think what this is really getting to is this argument that's been raised by the respondents of the gist and the sting of what they claim they said to the labor commissioner. So, if we're going to apply the gist and sting in this context on the first prong in any case, no matter what the claim is, the respondents simply aren't doing it right. And the reason they're not doing it right is that, as DeRozan instructs, we have to start with what the alleged communication is. So again, turning back to the complainant issue here, ASC alleges for the claims at issue, for 10 of the 11 claims, that the respondents fraudulently brought about the investigation before the labor commissioner. That was accomplished by the lodging of this first set of false wage complaints. So looking to those false wage complaints, the first set, we have to then, per Rosen, look at the statement, ask what's the gist and sting of that statement, and whatever else is reasonably inferred by it. So again, the first set of wage complaints say that these workers were on payroll as a laborer but conducting electrical work. So reasonably inferable from that is that ASC was falsifying its payroll records, right? So respondents err in two ways. First, they don't even address that communication. What they do is they start with all of these other communications, oral communications, interactions that they had with the labor commissioner, and then they say that those were truthful and those were, they fall within the protected categories. You have to start with what we're alleging, which is the first set of complaints. Then let's look at what they say is the truth. Well, the truth is that ASE was truthfully reporting multiple categories or classifications of prevailing wage worker in one day. Its truthful reporting also demonstrated that there were no foremen on certain days. That's the truth, all of which amounted to a dispute with the labor commissioner over whether she believed prevailing wage projects should be run that way. So on one hand, we have an allegation of falsified payroll records, and on the other, we have a dispute with the labor commissioner over how she believes these projects should be run. And so for gist and sting to really work for respondents here, you need apples and apples between the gist and sting of the alleged statement and the truth, and here we have apples and oranges. In addition to that, the determinations made by the labor commissioner, those are with respect to the union complaint. The union complaint, as shown by the determinations, is all about not falsified payroll records. It's all about split classifications in one day and no foreman. The settlement order is all about split classifications, and no foreman. You won't see anything in those about falsified payroll records. And so because the respondents below, and again before this court, really don't address the communication that is the basis of the claims, they did not meet their first prong burden, much less show that it was true or made without knowledge of falsity.
Let me ask you something. On you go back to split classifications and no foreman on the job. In this setting, would that prevent you from bidding on projects? If you were splitting classifications and not having foreman on the job?
I would say that no, subject to a caveat. I mean, it would have to go through the administrative process before the labor commissioner. She would actually have to find that that is a violation of prevailing wage law. And if she does that, then of course she could impose a disqualification on future bids, right? But
the contractors out there know you don't split the classifications and you've got to have a foreman on the job.
Well, I think there's a dispute in the record over that. I mean, certain contractors, for example, Helix Electric believes that you can't. Other contractors, for example, ATCO, there's testimony in the record that that contractor believes you can. Our client believes that it was always permissible under prevailing wage law. And importantly, I think we see from the labor commissioner's own statements that she says that it's not illegal. She just believes it shouldn't be done, which are very two different things. Again, because the respondents did not address the actual basis of the claims here, the lower court erred in concluding it carried its first prong burden as well. And in the absence of any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. May I proceed?
Yes.
Perfect. So I'd like to start by actually answering the questions asked by Justice Lee and then Justice Perigieri. First, NRS 41.637 provides four categories of protected communications. I believe that Mr. Futh's comments and communications with the NLC fit three of the four. So that's a direct response to your question, Justice Lee. In terms of your question under NRS 338, Justice Perigieri, that is true. Splitting classifications, having employees, a certain number of employees without a foreman, is a violation of 338 under the prevailing wage state statutes.
Mr. Parker, could you just address something that's been nagging me, at least?
Of course.
With respect, so we have the factors, I agree, the four categories of protected communications. But all of those communications have to be made in good faith.
Absolutely.
There is an allegation, and I'd like to flesh this out a little bit, that there was a false letter that was created by your client that was sent to the NLC in order to kind of drum up some interest in investigating their competitor. How is that fall within good faith communications? I'm not saying that all the communications weren't made in good faith, but that to me, if true, gives me a little bit of pause.
Certainly. And Justice Lee, I will tell you that that letter never saw the light of day. From based on the discovery we did and the discovery performed by the plaintiff and appellant, that letter never made its way out of Helix to the NLC or to anyone else.
Well, why was it done in the first place?
Based upon my involvement in the discovery in this case, Helix employee was working with employees or former employee of ASC, and they were actually going to submit for back wages under prevailing wage statutes. So that's why, it's my understanding, that's why that letter is being prepared.
But why fabricate a letter? Why not get an actual letter from one of those four former employees? I mean, we saw the email exchange back and forth and said the deed is done and I hope I don't get arrested or something to that effect. And then the NLC, I guess, director said she doesn't remember if she got it or not, and in any event, she didn't use it in her evaluation. But it concerns me that it was done with the intent to send it to the NLC, and it seems like, based on the email, that it was sent. And so I just, that this makes me very uncomfortable that your client would do something like that.
Certainly. I will tell you, Justice Lee, when I saw the email, I first wanted to see if it went somewhere. And it did not appear to have gone anywhere outside of the Helix umbrella. That's number one. And Shannon Chambers, the Nevada Labor Commissioner, didn't testify or provide in her affidavit that she ever received the letter. So to me, because it never got out of the Helix umbrella, it never was a part of the communications used to support the Nevada Labor Commissioner actually doing its own independent investigation.
And then what do you say to counsel's argument that the original communications with the NLC were making allegations of fraudulent payroll practices?
Oh, so that's where we start this. And I've had many cases in front of these two justices, but you're familiar with construction litigation as well. And Helix has been in this market for over 31 years. We all know on public works projects under 338, you have to submit certified payroll reports to the Nevada Labor Commissioner, and you also have to provide them to the owners, CCPSD, UNLV, all the public owners. So as a result, all of these contractors are looking at their certified payroll reports because they affect their bids. So what was happening, unfortunately for ASE, Helix and other electrical contractors with these unlimited licenses and unlimited bonding capabilities were checking out each other's CPR, certified payroll reports, so CPR. And you can tell if you have a certain number of employees whether or not a foreman should be identified with that requisite number of employees. They recognize, listen, they have no foreman and they're splitting classifications. So Mr. Fuchs of Helix referred it to Mr. Bybee of ABC. Says, Mr. Bybee, look at these reports, see if you come to the same conclusion. They came to the same conclusion. They submitted the information to the Nevada Labor Commissioner. The Nevada Labor Commissioner said, well, we need some more information. The first set of complaints didn't go anywhere. Then they provided additional information. And that's when Ms. Chambers got in, did a deep dive, and found out, and this goes back to one of the questions asked, and I apologize for getting to it sooner, when they realized that there was over $177,000 worth of unpaid or improperly paid wages. And getting to your question, Justice Barragheri, that supported the initial decision for 3 years of not being able to work bid on public works projects, to answer your question directly. So that's what ASE was up against. And then ASE, of course, filed a motion in the district court. Judge Alf prevented that three-year suspension, but put handcuffs in terms of the Nevada Labor Commissioner should be able to see your bids before they actually go out or before you get awarded these projects.
So it gives them an advantage in the bidding process.
Bingo. That's exactly right. And if you can do these projects, public works projects, where there's such a small margin of profit, because, as you know, on public works projects, typically all the contracts are a percentage in terms of change orders, and everyone's bidding it tight. So if someone can get away with breaking the rules, it affects the entire industry. So that's why, again, it fits, starting back where you said, Justice Lee, it starts right under 41637. Mm-hmm. Now, I will tell you, I was surprised by the arguments of ASC in terms of discovery. And when the concession was made just a few moments ago that arguably under 41637, that the communications were good faith communications, to me that ended this appeal. Because if you look at the 11 causes of action, we know that the abuse of process is not allowed under the Land Baron case. We also know that the other 11 causes of action,
Let me ask you about that, Mr. Parker, because not all of the communications were just to the NLC. There are other claims alleging intentional interference with prospective economic advantage on the Fertitta project by contacting people saying that there's going to be a determination forthcoming against ACE, as well as the intentional interference with Travelers, where Helix demanded that Travelers cease writing project bonds for ACE. So those fall outside of the purview of the statute. And so what saves that from being dismissed?
Thank you, Justice Lee. Thank you for teeing that up. The first one I did address was the abusive process. And I think we all agree that under the Lamb-Baron case, 131 Nevada 686, 2015 case, that the abusive process does not apply when you have a complaint to an administrative agency. Yeah. The next cause of action is this Unfair Trade Practice Act. Again, it's inapplicable under under NRS 598A040. That's, I think, very clear. The other causes of action, if you simply read the affidavit of Shannon Chambers, a Nevada Labor Commissioner, everything that they're complaining about, I split my time with Mr. Posenberg. You sure? Now, that's a treat. Where was the last time Mr. Posenberg conceded time? That is amazing. So, and I appreciate it. So, if you consider all of their claims, the remaining nine claims, the interim order is what they're basing their claims on. And the interim order was a product of an independent investigation by the Nevada Labor Commissioner. Going back to your question, Justice Lee, the communications with travelers, we deposed travelers. Travelers said, and this doesn't include or require weighing of the evidence under a summary judgment type consideration or standard. Travelers said ASC's own broker told them that they were not interested in any more bonds from travelers. That was the direct testimony. I was there. I took that deposition. I had the pleasure of being involved in all of these depositions. I could not believe the testimony from Raphael Construction, Whiting Turner, I believe, Martin Harris. Each one of them said they made their own decisions without any input from Helix. In fact, looking at travelers, because I know that's the one that you raised, Justice Lee, the travelers representative said, the 30B6, said, I've only heard of Helix. I've never spoken to anyone at Helix. They knew of Helix because Helix is in the marketplace. I have never seen such one-sided discovery. This, when you consider, this is something I wanted to talk about, but when counsel conceded the 637 comment to your question, Justice, it ended the whole evaluation of this case. But when you look at NRS 41660 subparagraph 4, and it says, this is unlike the California statute, by the way, mm-hmm. It allows discovery on both the to oppose and to defeat it, in support or in opposition to it. What is a judge to do when the parties virtually agree on every form of discovery, depositions, the limitation of those depositions, the number of depositions, the subpoenas, and request for production, when every party agrees to that sans two depositions that they did not agree with, really one, they didn't want us to take their 30B6 witness, and the labor of going through the discovery and then the fruits of that discovery prove that they can't support their case, they can't support a cognizable cause of action. And that's the difference. And so when I heard counsel try to find a thin line to argue that there was some weighing of the evidence that's not allowed under the rule, it would render this section of NRS 41660 meaningless if you're allowing for discovery to promote or support the motion and to oppose it. What's the purpose of the discovery? And in this case, the purpose was to determine if there was a cognizable claim, and all of them found to be not. They can support damages or causation. And their entire case is based upon the interim order from the Nevada Labor Commission. Now, I promised Mr. Posenberg the honeycut issues, the fees and cost issues, and the jurisdictional issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Discovery.
I'm sorry about the discovery. I was there.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Dan Posenberg. Actually, I'm for Victor Hughes. So let me pick up where Teddy left off. They accused Judge Alf of weighing the evidence, but she didn't weigh the evidence. What she did was look at exactly what these statutes were designed, the anti-SLAPP statutes were designed to allow. Now, Neil Gallatz taught me when I was a very young lawyer what you use a motion for summary judgment for. And especially when he was defending medical malpractice cases, you make a motion for summary judgment under 41A.100, and I'm sure you never thought I'd mention those again, to see if they can make out a case. And that's what we did here. And we had appropriate discovery here under 664, which says you can have discovery. It goes further than California. Discovery to help you meet the burden or oppose the burden. And that's what we were able to do. We were able to bring out evidence that showed they can't make a case. Let me give you one example since I have 2 minutes.
I mean, it seems in reading Judge Al's order, and this isn't a you all thing, this is, you know, the judge and we are kind of bound by her order. Seems in every of the causes of action, as she was analyzing it, she used that language where she says ASE fails to provide prima facie evidence to contradict their evidence. So it kind of appears from that she is absolutely weighing what they produce versus what the other side produced and saying it doesn't.
She does. I don't think she comes close to weighing the evidence. And I think you can make an argument that you could go further than she did. Let me give you an example. Repeatedly in their opening brief, 5 or 6 times, they say that Mr. Fuchs had the intent to put ASE out of business. And they drop a footnote and they put two citations for every time. One of those was the labor commissioner's email, and the other one was Mr. Bybee's testimony. And in her email, all she said is, I can't put somebody out of business. I have to follow a process. When they asked Mr. Bybee, well, where did the labor commissioner get that? Is it from something Mr. Fuchs said? No, don't know, don't remember. And we put in affirmative evidence that we didn't have these bad intents. So they're not entitled to the inferences from these vague things when we were able to put in concrete evidence. That's what this kind of motion is for. You can't continue a claim on the gossamer wings of whimsy and speculation, as Judge Alf said. This is more than a motion to dismiss. This is a motion that actually tests their evidence. They didn't have evidence on intent.
But they only have to make a prima facie evidence, right? I mean, showing at this stage,
right? Right. If they actually had evidence, but they're not allowed to say, we guess Mr. Fuchs said this because of something somebody else said, where she didn't say he said it. Mr. Bybee didn't say he said it. Mr. Fuchs said he didn't have that intent at all.
Let me ask you this.
How many of the claims they're making tied to the false letter?
As Mr. Parker said, to the false letter. No, the false letter is really nothing. It's hardly covered in any of the briefs. It didn't come up in discovery. The labor commissioner didn't see it.
What if, because my question was kind of dovetailing on that, what if this court decides there was prima facie evidence that letter was sent?
There isn't.
Well, but let's just assume for the moment that this court decides that there is. Is that a part of only one cause of action, 11 causes of action?
I don't think it's the analysis of prong one. Let's see if I can do this. All right, first, humor me and let me say there's no way on earth you could draw that conclusion. This is exactly what the anti-SLAPP statute is for, to get rid of cases when it's all based on speculation.
Understood.
This didn't go to the labor commissioner. This didn't go to anybody.
Okay, which I get, but now, in terms of my question, how does that affect the prong one analysis?
If we had actually sent it to the labor commissioner and the labor commissioner considered it and used it in determinations and it wound up causing damage, I think that we're still in whimsy and speculation, because there is proof here of no causation and no damages. Okay. I suppose you don't want to hear about the whether the findings of fact and conclusions of law are legal judgment.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, we'll add an extra minute to Mr. Chance's time as well.
Thank you. Let me answer your question with respect to the false letter. I think it actually ties into every cause of action that respondents have just pointed out to you are tied to the interim order, because the interim order was issued in the proceedings related to the first set of false complaints. Those complaints were initially closed. They were reopened because unspecified further information was provided by the respondents. The respondents have never said what that information is. The labor commissioner never said what that was. And then all of a sudden, it reopens. The respondents' own documents, their own emails, show that that false letter was sent. And there's a presumption that a letter sent is a letter received. And the fact that the labor commissioner, on the second prong, says, I never received it, there's a factual dispute there, right? So with respect to the fruits of discovery in this case, the fruits of discovery created a factual dispute. The fruits of discovery unearthed contrary factual arguments on the issues of causation and damages for the implicated claims in this case. There was not one legal defense that came out of that discovery. And so it's not an issue about whether an anti-SLAPP movement in any case is ever permitted to discover. We have never said that. What we have said is that it is tied to the respective burdens on the second prong. And the burden is...
What facts were unearthed in discovery that leads you to believe that your client has made a prima facie showing that he could prevail, or that it could prevail at the time of trial?
So the prima facie evidence that our client uncovered was the respondents are responsible for lodging the first set of false complaints. And within that proceeding, the unconstitutional interim order was issued. And it's not as if the respondents didn't have any input into that. And I understand that the labor commissioner says she made her own conclusions and determinations, but the evidence also shows that they were involved in that. They were pressing her to issue something to prevent ASE before a hearing, before any due process, to be prevented being awarded public works projects.
What about the side-by-side comparison discussed by Mr. Parker, that, you know, everyone was kind of looking at the wages and the foreman being on site, and it was noticeably different and disparate, and then alerting Mr. Bybee and others to that?
Sure. So again, I go back to, we have to start with what is the basis of the claims. The basis of the claims is the first set of wage complaints. And again, that allegation is, and I'm quoting, this is page 1396 of Appellant's Appendix, on payroll as laborer but conducting electrical work. That is falsified payroll records. And so to say that you can look at a payroll record only, because Mr. Fuchs says he only looked at 20 to 25 pages out of hundreds, that's all he looked at, to say that you can look at that and know that that is falsified, right, is impossible, because you don't know what work these employees were doing. There's no way to tell if someone classified as a laborer was actually doing electric work. That's why you have to do something else, and that's in fact why there is an investigation where other things are done. Interviews, reviewing daily reports, none of that was done here, and we still haven't heard why that person...
The investigation yielded a result that was basically, yeah, they're not properly classified.
It yielded a result that you cannot split classifications irrespective of the work actually being done. Meaning, if someone is on project on site under an electrical subcontract, and this is in the advisory opinions, the determinations, if you're there under the electrical scope of work, you've got to be an electrician. You can't be doing labor work. That's the dispute over split classifications. That doesn't have anything to do with falsified payroll reports. Because again, those payroll reports showing no foreman, showing the split classification, those are all truthful. Those show the actual classifications based on the actual work. So there is a distinct difference between falsified payroll and truthful reporting, and a dispute over with the labor commissioner over whether you can split classifications and not have a foreman.
So how do you make that distinction? Does it all come down to simply intent, and so you have to get into intent before you can make any type of claim like that?
No, you simply look at the face of the statement being alleged. This is the gist and sting, right? And you look at what is reasonably inferred by that statement. Again, the first set of wage complaints here are saying falsified payroll reports. On the other hand, what the respondents are offering is truthful payroll reports, which show split classifications. That's the distinction.
Did you want to finish your answer just in terms of what else discovery unearthed that you think made a prima facie showing?
Sure. So I think the be very brief. from the interim order, you see lost contracts. The Partita project is directly connected to that. You see a moratorium from UNLV from being awarded other purchase order work that had been part of that ongoing relationship. You have a chilling effect on submitting bids on CCSD projects based on the interim order and not being able to actually fulfill that project, and there's a penalty for that. And then an overall downturn in revenue year over year. That is evidence that was presented, that is accepted as true. All reasonable inferences are drawn in favor of ASC based on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this matter will stand submitted. Gentlemen, thank you. It's good to have you in court. I appreciate your argument. Take care. We'll be at ease for a minute while folks get set up for our next argument.
Thank you.